Chapter 47. Georgetown. St. Julian's wasn't a church, a university, or a hospital. It was St. Julian Perlmutter, an expert in all things nautical. A friend of Numa, he'd spent decades collecting books, charts, and other sources of information about the sea. If it was rare and unique, he searched it out and often paid top dollar to get it. In addition to auctions and private sales, Perlmutter had a network of contacts spread across the globe who would reach out to him if they found something of interest, or if a rumor crossed their desk regarding any mysteries hidden in the oceans. Kurt arrived at Perlmutter's home and pulled into the driveway, which ran between the ivy-covered walls of the neighboring houses that guarded the entrance to St. Julian's like the battlements of a walled city. Beyond them lay a spacious carriage house with more land around it than any home in Georgetown had a right to. It even had a large courtyard that St. Julian had roofed over and later enclosed completely so he could store more of his treasures. Kurt stepped from the jeep and shut the door. It had been a while since he'd visited, and he'd never arrived so late in the evening and unannounced. And yet before he could take a step toward the door, it swung open, spilling light onto the grounds. Most of that light was immediately blocked by the imposing shape of a 400-pound man in a silk robe. "Kurt Austin, darkening my door," a deep voice boomed. "What have I done to deserve this?" Kurt grinned at the welcome, noticing that Perlmutter hadn't trimmed the long beard or changed the style of the mustache that covered his lip and twisted at the ends. "St. Julian," Kurt said, "it's great to see you. But do you ever sleep?"
"Every chance I get."
"Then how is it you're always waiting at the door when I arrive? Cameras? Alarm system? Sixth sense you've never told us about?"
"Yes to all of the above," St. Julian replied. "And in your case, Fritz knows the sound of your jeep. He wags his tail incessantly the moment you pull into the driveway."
Kurt laughed. Fritz was Perlmutter's dachshund. The moment his name was spoken, he appeared in the doorway. He'd been a puppy the first time Kurt met him, though he was fully grown now and becoming rotund like his master.
"You see," Perlmutter said, "he's awfully fond of you, which doesn't say much for his breeding."
The joke didn't offend Kurt in the least. In fact, he laughed. This was how St. Julian greeted his true friends. If he'd been polite and proper, Kurt would have been worried.
"I'm sorry to bother you so late," Kurt said. "Can I bend your ear for a moment?"
"Certainly," Perlmutter said, waving Kurt in.
Kurt followed Perlmutter through the doorway and into the large but crowded house. They passed stacks of books 5 feet tall, tables covered with charts 6 inches deep, and shelves filled with journals, logbooks, records, and diaries from the owners, passengers, and crew of long-defunct steamship lines.
Kurt marveled at it all. "How many books do you have now?"
"I stopped counting at 10,000, Perlmutter said.
St. Julian had long ago filled his official library and since then had turned every room, closet, and nook in the home into an extension of that library. The only space completely free of books was the expansive kitchen, where he spent his time creating sumptuous dishes that would have earned him a Michelin star or two had his home been a restaurant. Even now, the aroma was enticing.
"Cognac or port?" Perlmutter said, arriving at a bar that was stocked from his personal wine cellar.
"Don't waste the good stuff on me," Kurt said. "I'm only here for information."
"Nonsense," Perlmutter said. He filled 2 balloon snifters with golden brown cognac from an aged bottle and passed one to Kurt.
"Now," Perlmutter said, "what is it you're searching for?"
"Information on the INS Dakar."
Perlmutter's memory was as quick and accurate as any computer's. He rattled off the basic facts.
"The Dakar was an Israeli vessel purchased from the British, lost with all hands in the Mediterranean, January of 68.
Perlmutter raised an eyebrow.
"A bad year for submarines, really.
That same year, the French lost the Minerve, we lost the Scorpion, and the Russians lost the K-129. Some people thought a secret war had broken out. As for the Dakar, its disappearance was considered mysterious due to conflicting time and position reports from the Israeli Navy
and an emergency buoy that washed up near Gaza a year later. Repeated Israeli searches failed to locate wreckage, and the ship's whereabouts remained unknown until 1999, when a joint U.S.-Israeli team found the ship several hundred miles east of Crete. End of story. That's the public information, Kurt said. I need the hidden truth. I have reason to believe that submarine was involved in something clandestine, but I've nothing to back that up. Perlmutter's mustache twitched as he considered this. Common sense would suggest that's highly unlikely. Why? She was on a shakedown cruise when she vanished, Perlmutter said. Her crew were mostly new recruits. They'd spent a month in England training with the Brits. Nothing outlandish about that. Also, she was in the process of being delivered. Unlikely that she would be on a secret mission before she'd ever reached Israel to be fitted out. And yet the erroneous position reports suggest something was going on, Kurt said. Perlmutter tugged thoughtfully on his beard. I must admit there have always been rumors about that vessel. The sinking, the disappearance, even the search for it were controversial. At one point, a high-ranking Israeli officer claimed the government had deliberately misled those who'd been looking for her, because they didn't want the wreck to be found. But it was discovered, Kurt questioned, and the Israelis had parts of the ship salvaged, including the bridge, right? Perlmutter nodded. There was talk of bringing the whole ship up, but it was too costly and complicated an endeavor, especially as the wreck lies so deep. Kurt said, the question I have is, why consider it at all? We've salvaged a few ships in our time. No one goes to that expense unless there's an incredibly important, even singular reason for doing so. Usually something on the sunken vessel that a government wants or something they don't want anyone else to have. Which makes me think the Dakar was carrying something the Israeli government wanted kept secret. Perlmutter looked slightly out of sorts. He shifted in his chair and took another sip of the cognac, and then placed the glass down slowly. I have roughly thousands of volumes of various types here, Kurt, and I can assure you there's nothing in any of them to support your theory. I'll accept that, Kurt said, but there are other forms of information, including word of mouth, and I know you speak with people who talk off the record. And honoring those commitments, I know you've never written a single word of it down. But you have it all stored. Kurt tapped the side of his head. Up here. Perlmutter's frame stiffened. Talk and innuendo are dangerous things to trade in, especially when one is grasping at straws. You never know who will hand you a few, only to watch you fall. I imagine this has something to do with Joe and Ms. Priya disappearing. It does, Kurt admitted. He brought St. Julian up to speed on everything that had happened, filling him in on the link to the oil crisis and to what Miyar had told him. Right now, I have nothing else to go on. I have no way to stop what we're dealing with, no way to track down the people who took Priya, and no chance of bringing them to justice for what happened to Joe. If straws are all that are left, I'm reaching for them with both hands. So if you have any information suggesting the Dakar was involved in a clandestine mission and carrying a secret cargo when she went down, I need to hear it. There have always been rumors about that vessel, Perlmutter admitted. Most are frivolous. But there is one I've heard that may interest you. Several years ago, almost a decade now, I was in France having dinner at a wonderful gastropub with a colleague from the French Military Historical Society. We were on our second bottle of wine when the subject of missing vessels came up. I told him a few stories from Numa's list of great discoveries. Nothing classified, I assure you. Suitably impressed, he tried to match me, story for story. Eventually, he asked if I'd heard the true story of the Dakar. Naturally intrigued, I told him I had not. He agreed to enlighten me, but spoke in the vaguest of terms. At any rate, his intimation was that the French Air Force had sent the Dakar to the bottom, not a malfunction or accident. Kurt narrowed his gaze. The French Air Force? Why would they sink an Israeli sub? Perlmutter stroked his beard. My friend wouldn't say. But he offered a possible answer in the form of another rumor. This one suggested the French and Israelis had jointly developed a new weapon, something to be used in the event of another Arab invasion. He told me others thought it might be a hydrogen bomb, which is logical, as the French were helpful in the creation of the Israeli nuclear program. But he personally thought it was something more sinister. He described it as being a doomsday weapon. Doomsday? My friend is fond of dramatic terms, Perlmutter said. Upon later explanation, I understood him to mean a weapon that couldn't be stopped once it was unleashed. Not even at the border. Biological, Kurt said. Perlmutter nodded. All too common today, but rare back then. According to my friend, the two nations had designed this weapon together before they began fighting over it. The French were afraid, insisting a countermeasure be developed. The Israelis were firmly against this, but finally acquiesced. Once the weapon and its antidote had both been perfected, the Israelis stole the whole kit and caboodle, loaded it aboard the Dakar, and sailed for Israel. Unwilling to lose what they believed to be their rightful creation, the French hunted the Dakar down and sank it. Kurt knew he was onto the truth now. He took another sip of the cognac, reached down to scratch Fritz on the head, and then stood. You're going. You've given me what I need, Kurt replied. I've given you a rumor, Perlmutter corrected, and only because you asked me to. You must know, that particular friend has a fairly suspect record when it comes to veracity. I think your friend told you the truth, Kurt said. What's more, he might have given us the key to prevent this oil shock from becoming a lasting crisis. I have to go. Keep well. I'll stay longer next time, and we'll drink the rest of that bottle. Kurt left Perlmutter's home with a wave of energy surging through his body. He dialed Rudy on his phone, using the Bluetooth connection in the Jeep to talk over the speakers. I'm headed to the airport, he told Rudy. I need Paul, Gamay, and all the deep diving equipment you can pull together in an hour. Rudy, who was rarely shocked, seemed at a loss. Why? Because I'm flying to Crete, and I'm diving on the INS Dakar. The Dakar? The submarine? That's what Miar was trying to tell us, Kurt replied. When I asked him about the oil-destroying bacteria, he said, Le Dakar. The Dakar. The submarine, not the city. Seems like a stretch, Rudy said. Not after what St. Julian just told me. Kurt went on to explain the rumor Perlmutter had just relayed to him. He does have a spy network that would make the CIA proud, Rudy said. But you're still making a giant leap of faith and landing on a very shaky conclusion. How would Tessa even find out about this weapon? Pascal Miar, Kurt said. He's the link. He spent years as the director of biological research for the French military, and then held the same role on the civilian side with the French Ministry of Science. At that time, he was given the additional title Director of Ethics Administration. He was in a position to know these secrets, and once he was fired and censured, he would be in a position to trade on them. I suppose the timing fits, Rudy said. We've been piecing his background together. He left France and started working for Tessa before this oil crisis began. How they met, I don't know, Kurt admitted. But at some point, Miar told her about the oil destroyer and its resting place on the Dakar. Tessa, being a risk-taker whose alternative energy company is floundering, comes up with the plan of the century. Destroy the world's oil. Tell yourself that you're saving the planet and make billions on the back end. Audacious, Rudy replied. Do you have anything beyond the rumor St. Julian told you about and the circumstantial link you just gave me? Like a method by which this oil destroyer gets from a submarine at the bottom of the sea and into Tessa's hands? Tessa has a wealth of equipment at her disposal. Submersibles, aircraft, ships. She also has a historical preservation society that's done work all around the globe. That LNG carrier in Bermuda was one of her presents to the world at large, but there have been others. Look up her efforts and I guarantee you'll find her historical preservation society operating near the Dakar between the time Miyar began working for her and the start of this oil crisis.
Stand by, Rudy said. I'll check.
The wait was longer than Kurt expected, but he continued toward the airport without slowing down.
Anything?
You're dead on, Rudy said finally. 2 years ago, Tessa's foundation spent 3 months and $60 million on a deepwater archaeological expedition in the Eastern Med. It was supposed to be cataloging and recovering Minoan artifacts, but despite the cost and time spent, there was very little to show for the effort.
And the location? Kurt asked.
They did work over a small geographic area, Rudy said, but never more than 10 miles from where the Dakar went down.
They weren't looking for amphoras and statues of Poseidon, Kurt said. They were diving on the wreck, trying to find whatever type of sealed protective containers the oil-destroying cultures were stored in.
You've convinced me, Rudy said. But if she's already been there, what good is searching the Dakar going to do us?
It was time to deliver the good news.
Perlmutter's friend said there was a countermeasure to the bioweapon, a counteragent, an antidote, the completion of which was the cause of the rift between the Israelis and the French in the first place. As it happens, I asked Miyar how we could destroy the bacteria. His response was odd to me. He said they didn't find it. It wasn't there. At the time, I thought he was just confused. But now it makes perfect sense. Tessa's people found the oil destroyer, but not the counteragent.
Which means it might still be there.
Exactly, Kurt said. It's not easy to search every square inch of a sunken vessel, especially at that depth, and especially when you're doing it in secret. For what they wanted to do, the oil destroyer was far more important than the counteragent. Once they had it, there was little incentive to keep looking for its antidote. But we have every incentive in the world.
I assume you're still driving to the airport, Rudy said.
Halfway there.
Keep going, Rudy said.
We should probably expect trouble, Kurt pointed out. I think it's time we broke out more than the standard issue equipment.
I know what you'll need, Rudy said.
Don't worry, you'll have it. Just get to the airport and start loading. I'll make sure everything else is waiting for you in Crete.